Two Kingdoms, number 46, Alexander Henderson, part 1. Okay, so before we get to Alexander Henderson, someone asked last week about this guy John Coffey, who is the Cambridge-educated historian who wrote the book, the biography of Rutherford that we looked at. Someone was asking about where he came from, I guess philosophically speaking. This book is a book-length rebuttal of an article that John Coffey wrote. The article's in the back of the book. The author of the book, Stephen Perks, has entitled his appendix. It contains the articles. The article, How Evangelicals Shouldn't Think About Politics. But the real title of the article, as originally appeared, is How Should Evangelicals Think About Politics? Roger Williams and the Case for Principled Pluralism. Okay, so he Coffey's a pluralist in the, I guess you could say, in the Williams tradition. And Stephen Perks has written a book-length rebuttal called A Defense of the Christian State. There's really two parts. The first part is the rebuttal, and the second part is the sort of an alternative view. If you wanted to get this book, it would be very hard for you to obtain. Well, I don't know, but the Alan ordered a copy for me, one copy for me, one copy for him. From the thank you, Alan. If you're listening, I really appreciate you ordering that book.
We'd appreciate it too, Alan.
But the he ordered it from the National Reform Association, who said they had it, and then like 11 weeks went by or 12 weeks, you know, and 4 emails. And finally it showed up. Oh, I think actually one copy showed up. I don't know if Alan really ever got his copy. He let me. I don't know if he. I think he got his copy eventually. So it might be of interest to some of you. Okay, we're going to talk about another one of the Scottish reformers of the second Scottish Reformation. That's Alexander Henderson. I'm just going to point out there's sort of two in terms of references. In case you're interested. One is this book, which I have, as you can see, it's a rare bound photocopy, called Lives of Alexander Henderson and James Guthrie with specimens of their writings. It's published in, I think, 1846 by the Free Church of Scotland. And the first part, obviously I'm using the part on Alexander Henderson, not the part on James Guthrie for today, is written by Thomas McCree, who also wrote a biography of Knox and a biography of Melville, both of which were very influential. The other resource would be very easy for you to find, and that is the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland magazine had an 11-part series on the life of Alexander Henderson, and I've printed it out, and then I've been flipping the pages around, so it's no longer in order or anything, but if you're interested, email me, and I will email you a list of URLs. It would be a lot easier for you to find that way, because if you go to their web pages, it turns out some of the links are broken. So I had to guess at what they were until I found the right article. And so, but, well, their thing, it's all organized like under every issue, then they have /article 1, article 2, and some of the links were broken, so I just went through article 1, article 2, until I found the right article, and so got it all worked out. Okay, well, Alexander Henderson was another important actor, if you will, in the events of the 1630s and 1640s. Let's see, he wrote a number of the important documents, such as the part of the National Covenant. He was the moderator of the 1638 Glasgow General Assembly that overturned most of the innovations made by the James and Charles. And he was a member of the Westminster Assembly. He was somewhat older than Samuel Rutherford. And I think I said earlier that I was going to do these biographies on people who sort of lived in, you know, who were a bridge between what we'd covered before and what we covered, what we will cover. And actually, he dies before we really get to the next section, but still thought it was a useful biography and there's several places in his life which are sort of just different from Samuel Rutherford that might, you know, I thought were interesting. So, okay, well, relatively little is known about his early life other than the fact that he was born about 1583 in northeast Fife, which Fife is the area of Scotland sort of north of Edinburgh across the Firth of Forth. And he entered the University of St. Andrews in 1599. He distinguished himself there, graduating in 4 years. Then he taught philosophy there. In fact, he was there until, I think, 1611 or something like that. So you could say he was a professional student for a while or something. No, he stayed on. He taught philosophy there. So, University of St. Andrews was where Andrew Melville was. His Henderson's education at the university overlapped Melville. Okay, Melville had come to the university in 1580, and he was a principal of St. Mary's College. He reorganized it as a divinity school. 1584, Melville had to flee to England to avoid the wrath of the Earl of Arran. When he returned, James confined Melville to the north of Scotland before he allowed him to return to St. Andrews in 1586, although he was prohibited from preaching. In 1595 and again in 1596, Melville made the Two Kingdoms speech to the king, right, the one we take our class name from. 1595 and 1596. So this was just a few years before Henderson came. 1598, Melville was ordered by James to leave the General Assembly in Dundee, and he was prohibited by the king from taking part in the 1600 General Assembly. 1602, he was confined to the college for some critical remarks he made about the state of the church. 1606, James summoned him to London, and then in 1607 to 1611, he was imprisoned in the Tower of London, okay, before he went into exile in France. So I bring up that quickly. I think you probably remember some of the history, but just the dates overlap quite closely Alexander Henderson's tenure there. So you might think at this point that I would say that you know, that Alexander Henderson was influenced by Melville, and that would later explain his, you know, rise to prominence and so on in the Scottish Church. But you would be dead wrong if you thought that. So, or maybe he was influenced negatively. Henderson was actually a prelate, an advocate of prelacy. According to McCree, Mr. Henderson, being then a young man and ambitious of preferment, became a warm advocate for the new measures. Okay, those James's reinstatement of the bishops and so on. Though the authority is not the best, yet there is reason to think what Bishop Guthrie says of him is not without foundation, that, quote, being professor of philosophy in St. Andrews, he did at the laureation of his class choose Archbishop Gladstanes for his patron, with a very flattering dedication for which he had the Kirk of Lucres given him shortly after. I'm waiting to see if Simon's going to correct my pronunciation. Yeah. Oh, that's correct. Well, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. Okay. Of course, he doesn't know what I'm looking at here. Might be some other word. Okay, I'm going to say Lucres. It's L-E-U-C-H-A-R-S. Okay, according to McLeod, the Free Presbyterian Church minister who wrote this series of articles, Henderson, let's see, speaking of Henderson, he was still unconverted and thoroughly in sympathy with the Episcopal Party and the Church. In his earliest surviving letter, Henderson describes Gladstanes as the most reverend father in God, our very prudent chancellors. Okay, and Gladstanes had been brought to St. Andrews in order to counterbalance the influence of Andrew Melville. So, Henderson, after spending a relatively long and distinguished career at the University of St. Andrews, he was appointed to a church near St. Andrews in Lucres, about 5 miles away. He was, as is sometimes said, you'll sometimes hear that someone was intruded on the church. On the day he was to be installed, the locals nailed up the door. So, yeah, no doubt. So, Henderson and Edmerson had to Had to break. They broke a window and crawled through the broken glass. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so as McCree says, when a sober people discover such violent symptoms of dissatisfaction with the minister, there is reason to conclude that there is something wrong either with the candidate or the manner of his introduction among them. In the present instance, there were both. For the person who was appointed to take the oversight of them not only was known to be a defender of these corruptions to which the great body of the people in Scotland were averse, but discovered little or no regard to the spiritual interests of the flock upon whom he had been obtruded. The most unhappy connection, which is probable would only have continued until his interest had procured him a change to a better living, had not every ground of dissatisfaction between him and the people been removed, and a foundation of lasting comfort between them laid in the merciful ordination of God. So McCree alludes to the fact, I mean, I don't really know, but presumably Henderson, you know, spending, you know, so many years at St. Andrews, and then going out to the ministry, it'd be like the guy who needs to get a little experience out in the field before he can take over as manager. You know, and presumably would have worked his way up through the church until he was a, you know, archbishop himself. Certainly showed the kind of talent in later years that if his mind had been turned in that direction, you know, he probably would have had every reason to do well. But that wasn't to be. Shortly after he came to that church, Robert Bruce was preaching in the area at a communion service. And Robert Bruce, you may recall, had been a minister in Edinburgh, St. Giles, was moderator of the General Assembly of 1588. And while James had been away to get married, Bruce was the minister who was made an extraordinary member of the Privy Council. And James later declared that Bruce was worth the quarter of his kingdom. I know that James was really sincere, but that's what he said. James's regard waned somewhat, and when Bruce refused to give James's side of the Gowrie conspiracy from the pulpit, right, this is where supposedly these guys had taken him into the castle and told him the story about a pot of gold and locked all the doors behind him and then attacked him. You know. Anyways, when Bruce had refused to sort of do from the pulpit, give James the side of the story, and I guess he was supposed to give a prayer of thanksgiving and have a national holiday and so on, James banished Bruce to France. Then he later allowed him to return and stay sometime in his home in Kinnaird or up in Inverness. He was banished up to the north, which wasn't near as nice a place then as it is now. And then from 1613 on, he was allowed back to his home in Kinnaird and had some freedom in traveling. And he used some of that freedom to preach at various sorts of communion services and fasts and so on. So, liking McCree's account, I'll just quote it. Hearing of a communion in the neighborhood at which Mr. Bruce was expected to assist, Mr. Henderson, attracted by his fame, or from some other motive, went thither secretly and placed himself in a dark corner of the church where he would remain most concealed. Mr. Bruce came into the pulpit, and after a pause, according to his usual manner, which fixed Mr. Henderson's attention on him, he read with his accustomed emphasis and deliberation these words as his text. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, is a thief and a robber. Words so descriptive of the character of an intruder and so literally applicable to the manner in which he entered upon his ministry at Lucre's went like drawn swords through the heart of Mr. Henderson. He who wished to conceal himself from all felt that he was naked and open to the word of God. The secrets of his heart were made manifest, his conscience convicted, and yielding to the force of divine truth, he worshipped God, and going away reported that God was of a truth in those whose ways were so opposite to his own. In one word, the discourse of that powerful preacher on this occasion was, by the divine blessing, the means of Mr. Henderson's conversion. Henderson later looked back on this in 1638 at the General Assembly. He spoke out sometimes saying, there are diverse among us that have had no such warrant for our entry to the ministry as were to be wished. Alas, how many of us have rather sought the kirk than the kirk sought us? How many have rather gotten the kirk given to them than have been given to the kirk for the good thereof? And yet there must be a great difference put between those who have lived many years in an unlawful office without warrant of God, and therefore must be abominable in the sight of God, and those who in some respects have entered unlawfully and with an ill conscience, and afterwards have come to see the evil of this, and to do what in them lies to repair the injury. B. Henderson. The one is like a marriage altogether unlawful and null in itself. The other is like a marriage in some respects unlawful and inexpedient, but that may be mended by the diligence and fidelity of the parties in doing their duty afterwards. So should it be with us who entered lately into the calling of the ministry. If there were any faults or wrong steps in our entry, as who of us are free, acknowledge the Lord's calling of us if we have since got a seal from heaven of our ministry, and let us labor with diligence and faithfulness in our office. So, by the way, this business about entering the church through the broken window, I don't know how common that was, but there's actually a novel written by John Galt called Annals of the Parish. And in the opening scene, that's basically exactly what happens. So, the guy has to enter through, he goes to get installed in the parish. So, unless he was basing it just on this one other incident, it maybe was a little more reasonably common. Well, Henderson apparently never did look back. The Articles of Perth were passed by a Whig General Assembly in 1618, and there was at a meeting of the Synod of Fife the next year, it was reported that Henderson had not conformed to the practice of kneeling in communion. The Synod minutes recorded that it is not of contempt as he deponed solemnly, but because he is not fully persuaded of the lawfulness thereof. He is exhorted to strive for obedience and conformity. In August of the next year, he and two other ministers were called before a court of high commission for supposedly publishing a book called Perth Assembly, which showed that assembly was invalid. The commission's inquiry came to nothing. Don't think Henderson actually published the book, so maybe off the hook on that standpoint. But apparently at this time many honest ministers were greatly harassed on account of their nonconformity. It was such a widespread problem that the bishops weren't able to rigidly enforce compliance in all areas of the country. And McCree mentions the West Country, in other words where Samuel Rutherford was from, and Fife, where Henderson was, as two such areas where they had a hard time rigidly enforcing compliance. Okay, so Henderson pastored this small church until 1637, for the most part out of the limelight. He evidently spent a fair amount of time studying theology and church history, occasionally met like-minded brothers at fasts and communions. I say occasionally, but he evidently got to be fairly well known, as Samuel Rutherford wrote him a letter which included the following: "As for your cause, my reverend and dearest brother, ye are the talk of the north and the south, and look to so as if ye were all crystal glass. Your motes and dust would soon be proclaimed and trumpets blown at your slips, but I know that ye have laid help upon one that is mighty. And trust not your comforts to men's airy and frothy applause, neither lay your downcastings on the tongues of salt mockers and reproachers of godliness." So during this time, Henderson evidently did, gain some renown. In a 1960 book by Marcus Lone called Makers of Church Freedom or something like that, said Rutherford knew, as others knew, that Henderson combined a clear mind with a firm grasp of affairs. He was known as a man with a high-minded sense of courtesy and debate, and a clear-sighted gift for promptitude and action. He was quiet and grave in manner, but he spoke with fluent ease and authority. He had always excelled as a spontaneous speaker, yet his utterances were so clear and rounded that they always seemed to suggest full and careful preparation. Maybe he went to Toastmasters, I'm not sure. Unlike Samuel Rutherford, right, who had been removed from his pastorate and was off in Aberdeen when all these events happened, Henderson was in the saddle, to use a mixed metaphor. At the time, he... I guess you could say he was carrying his crook or something, might be better. But shortly after the Edinburgh stool-throwing outburst of the 23rd of July, 1637, Archbishop Spottiswoode proclaimed Henderson and two other ministers Rebels, because they hadn't purchased the new service book, the Book of Common Prayer, for use in their parishes. Okay, instead of just meekly submitting to that, they appealed to the Privy Council, and they submitted a petition that asked the Privy Council to reverse the order that the new book be used. And presumably Henderson wrote this petition, or at least wrote part of it, and included the following points. Because the said service book is not warranted by General Assemblies, which is the representative kirk of this kingdom, and hath ever since the Reformation given direction in matters of God's worship, nor by any act of Parliament which in things of this kind have ever been thought necessary by His Majesty and Estates. Now keep in mind that Charles had basically stopped the General Assembly from meeting altogether, so in the nature of the case, then you wouldn't be able to make any changes to the church. Because the liberties of the true Kirk and the form of worship and religion received at the Reformation and universally practiced since then are warranted by acts of General Assemblies and diverse acts of Parliament, 1567, and of the late Parliament, 1633. 3. The Kirk of Scotland is an independent Kirk, and her own pastor should be most able to discern and direct what do best seem our measure of reformation, what may serve most for the good of the people. 4. It is not unknown to your lordships what disputing, division, and trouble have been in the Kirk about some few of the many ceremonies contained in this book, which being examined, as we shall be ready at a competent time assigned by your lordships to show, will be found to depart far from the worship and reformation of this Kirk, and in points most material for the Kirk of Rome, for her hierarchy and doctrine, superstition and idolatry and worship, tyranny and government and wickedness, every way as anti-Christian now as it when it came out of her. 5. The people have been otherwise taught by us and our predecessors in our places ever since the Reformation, and so it is likely they will be found unwilling to the change of whatever they be essayed, even when their pastors are willing, in respect whereof said letters of warning, whole effect and execution ought to be simpliciter suspended in time coming. So, I think it's a good example of an appeal to the civil magistrate. It touches quite a bit on the partly on the church's concerns, but partly also on the civil magistrate's concerns. You know, hey guys, they were rioting in Edinburgh, did you know? So we don't think this is such a good idea. Well, the resistance continued to organize. Charles tried to get the Privy Council to overawe the protesters, but finally this built to the point where Charles refused to hear any appeal. And then the protesters decided to write a bond or a covenant, right? The National Covenant of 1638. And they were meeting as a committee of estates, sort of an alternative parliament. And they appointed Alexander Henderson, who was now age 55, and Archibald Johnston, who was in his 20s, to draft this new covenant. Johnston was an attorney. And he wrote the first part of the covenant was the National Confession, or the King's Confession of 1581. So then Johnston wrote the second part, which was the legal background, and then Henderson wrote the third part, which gives the modern application of the previous covenants. And you can go back and, well, the National Covenant is in the Westminster book that we have. I think you all have a copy of it. And or you go back to lesson 29 if you're really hard up for something to do. Okay. But in short, the third part of the National Covenant states that the innovations forced on the church had no warrant from the Word of God, were contrary to the previous confession of the church, were contrary to previous acts of Parliament, intended to reestablish the popish religion and tyranny. Furthermore, it promised that the signers would stand in the defense of the king and in the defense and preservation of the true religion, liberties, and laws of the kingdoms. Okay, needless to say, Charles was not impressed with this this document. Isn't this what he called the first issue from that stable, from the stable of horses? Let's see. Right after that, Henderson preached a sermon back at his own church, and Like Rutherford, Henderson combined a warm experiential Christianity with this careful thought about applying it to the world and biblical worldview. And just to give you an idea, this is an excerpt from a prayer at this service right after the signing of the National Covenant. Lord, it is over much that we fail, so oft as we do, of ignorance and weaknesses, but that we should go against the light of our own minds, and so wrong our own consciences. This is a fearful, yea, and almost a desperate case. And therefore, O mighty God, while thou calls upon us, for while thou calls, it is not in vain, while thou lights thy candle and has any lost money to seek, while thou sends out the good shepherd to bring home the wandering sheep on his shoulders, now for Jesus Christ's sake, look where we are hiding ourselves. Sweep the house and find us out and gather us into thy treasures. And where we are wandering on the mountains of sin, following the silliness of our own hearts and exposing ourselves to be praised to Satan and all our enemies, Lord, take us on the shoulders of thy mercy and bring us home again to thy sheepfold. In an admonition to the congregation at the same service, he said, surely the Lord will not take it in good part that we be crying for a reformation in the Kirk, if in the meantime we be not crying also and laboring earnestly for a reformation in our own hearts. If there be an abomination and hypocrisy in the sight of God, this is it. Didn't want you to think he was just, you know, just striving for, you know, reforming the church and so on. But he was obviously very well loved by his parishioners. So it's probably no surprise then that Henderson was elected moderator of the General Assembly held in Glasgow in November 1638. Okay, this was the General Assembly where the King's Commissioner Hamilton stayed for 8 days to no avail, trying to get the right clerk elected, the one with the right precedence, and challenging the authority of the Assembly. And shortly before he left, Henderson and the commissioner, Hamilton, had the following interchange after a declinature. In this case, the declinature was from the bishops who were declining the authority of the Assembly to act against them. Henderson, it hath been the glory of the Reformed churches, and we counted our glory after a special manner, to give unto kings and Christian magistrates what belongs unto their places. Next to piety towards God, we are obliged unto loyalty and obedience to our king. There is nothing due unto kings and princes in matter ecclesiastical, which I trust by this assembly shall be denied unto our king. A great equivocating statement, if ever there was. they clearly planned to deny plenty, but only that which were things that weren't due to the king. So the Christian magistrate hath power to convoke assemblies when they find that the urgent affairs of the Kirk do call for them. And in assemblies, when they are convened, his power is great, and his power ought to be heard. And we heartily acknowledge that your grace, as his majesty's high commissioner, in representing his majesty's person, has a chief place in this reverend and honorable assembly. What is Caesar's and what is ours, let it be given to Caesar. But let the God by whom kings reign have his own place and prerogative. Hamilton, sir, you have spoken as a good Christian and dutiful subject. I am hopeful that you will conduct yourself with that deference you owe to your royal sovereign, all of whose commands will, I trust, be found agreeable to the commandments of God. Henderson, I now ask if this assembly finds themselves competent judges of the prelates. And that was, they had to answer this question, this declinature. Hamilton, if you proceed to the censure of their persons and offices, I must remove myself. Nay, with your grace's permission, that cannot be. Okay, Hamilton then reaffirmed that he must withdraw. Henderson, 1,000 times I wish the contrary from the bottom of my heart, and that your grace would favor us with your presence without obstructing the work and freedom of this assembly. Hamilton again demanded that the assembly be closed, but Henderson wouldn't yield, so Hamilton pronounced his own dissolution in the king's name of the assembly. And they'd already had a protestation available. They'd written earlier in the day. they being the, I guess you could call it the reformers, read by the clerk, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, the only head and monarch of his church, from a consciousness of our duty to God and his truth, the king and his honor, the kingdom and her peace, this assembly and her freedom and the safety of ourselves and our posterity, in our persons and estates, we profess with sorrowful but heavy and heavy but loyal hearts we cannot dissolve this assembly. Henderson spoke then and said, all that are here know the reasons of the meeting of this assembly, and albeit we have acknowledged the power of Christian kings for convening of assemblies and their power in assemblies, yet that may not derogate from Christ's right, for he has given divine warrants to convoke assemblies, whether magistrates be present or not. Therefore, seeing we perceive men to be so zealous of their master's commands, have we not also good reason to be zealous toward our Lord, and to maintain the liberties and privileges of his kingdom? Ye all know that the work in hand has had many difficulties, and God has borne us through them all to this day. Therefore, it becometh us not to be discouraged by anything that has intervened, but rather to double our courage when we seem to be deprived of human authority. Okay, after this, the assembly voted to continue their work, and with only three or four no votes, they then went on to try and depose the number of the bishops. Well, some they excommunicated, some they deposed, some they suspended. And they repealed all or nearly all of the innovations forced on the church by James and Charles. Against his wishes and against the wishes of his parishioner, the General Assembly also transferred Alexander Henderson to Edinburgh, and where he was then to become minister at St. Giles. And also during this meeting, he spent quite a bit of time with the Earl of Argyll, who was a member of the Privy Council and later a Covenanter leader. And the Earl of Argyll traced his conversion, or at least the assurance of his salvation, to this time that he spent with Henderson. So, probably, why don't we stop there. And are there any questions?
This is a question about practice. Have you ever come? What is this idea of preaching at fasts? What was the fast that those folks did back then? A fly.
I'm being attacked by a fly here. Dave, do you want to answer that?
Well, I think the idea was to call for particular days of fasting under local or regional or international distress to sell God's hand upon them. They might have days set apart where people had been fasting and having preached sermons to help the congregation become aware of the prevailing circumstances and better realize God's judgment that was on them at the time.
Yeah, I think.
I don't know of particular events which required a call for fasting. I think it'd be much like today we might have a national day of Thanksgiving. We might have a day of fasting.
They were poor, and it was easier to afford to fast than to get. Now, I don't know a lot about specific events, but I mean, obviously, they had a lot of trying times. Then, and I believe they called these fasts to have a time of prayer and to beseech God to preserve them. So.
Well, we seem to, we have our communion. Bring in speakers for communion, but we seem to drop that. Why that is?
Yeah, we.
Maybe because we like to eat too much.
Probably because we like to eat too much.
Convenient.
It'd be inconvenient to fast.
The church has done. I know at least once. We have fast. That's been a few years ago.
Yeah. Must have been before Mike came.
Yeah. That's when guys were still skinny or something like that.
I don't really remember the circumstances, but Sounds vague. It does sound vaguely familiar.
Which is when we went to Stillwater Watch Sing Fest, but of course got to hear all these other worship bands and so on play. But it struck me as you were going through this, I mean, both Rutherford and Henderson had a very strong experiential dimension to their faith, but it was grounded in tremendous theological depth. It wasn't in the thin topsoil of charismatic music or whatever. But it struck me that seems to be something that seems to be something that Reformed, just speaking painting with a very broad brush, it seems to be something that Reformed churches have lost in one sense, and perhaps is the answer to perhaps something that we should pursue in as an answer to the charismatic charge that we're the frozen chosen who don't have any, you know, who intentionally hold experience at arm's length as if it has no place in religion. I think J.I. Packer made that point a long time ago. He wrote a book called Keep in Step with the Spirit, and he made that. I think he made that point in the book that in his opinion, the charismatic movement arose largely as a response to the fact that this has been lost in the Reformed Church. That there's, you know, there was something to the charge.
Somewhat of a strange response, but
yeah, quite strange. He wasn't.
Yeah, no, one of the reasons I read a little bit from Rutherford and Henderson on this issue is because in a church history class you might get the idea that these people were just, you know, promoters of certain ideas and so on. But that, you know, in fact, they had a very deep experiential faith, and, you know, so deep that in Rutherford's case, all these people have appropriated his, you know, letters or portion, usually abridged versions of the letters. So, Mike.
But you wouldn't have it, at least I think it'd be hard to conjure up experiential faith and so forth unless you heard it, you know, later on in life.
Yeah.
So that's sure a great help in that case. That they saw how to pray they were before they were saved and when they got converted. I mean, all of a sudden you're going to be very thankful.
Oh, I think I disagree. I mean, I don't think that experience is reserved for those who, unless I'm hearing you wrong, it's not reserved for those who are converted from. I don't think so.
Well, Rutherford, I don't think there's any evidence that he was. I mean, there's not enough known about his early life to say that he was ever particularly rebellious, other than this, you know, other than his sort of the one episode and his own testimony, which in a sense may speak to that, but in another sense, you know, I think when we appreciate how holy and righteous God is, we all fall so far short that someone has a true experience of that might not have lived a sort of worldly rebellious life to speak as Rutherford did about their early life. And so Mike's for the tape. Mike's shaking his head and smiling here. I've obviously made some mistake here. Go ahead, Mike.
Just on the realm of contrast, it's always in one person's mind, it's always the great solidifier. And, you know, when you look back at what you were and what you are now, so forth and so on, that brings out about a true heartfelt thankfulness, so forth and so on. In then that's what you call experiential. In fact, if you've experienced that, so forth, and that brings upon thanksgiving in your heart. What you're saying is that, in a sense, if I really, I guess you'd say, was pretty good all my life.
Yeah.
My sins were probably false sins or something like that. But I can be, that on the whole, I can be as thankful as a person who came out of the gutter.
Yeah,
and I disagree.
But the reason I would say that is because as you draw near to God, your perception of how good you were deteriorates remarkably. So the more you progress in your Christian life in drawing near to God and experiencing His presence, the more realistic your view becomes of how you really are. And then your thankfulness and your praise and your worship goes up commensurately, and your opinion of yourself goes down.
And I would say to you, theoretically, that sounds good.
Oh, I think it is what happens. I think it's what should happen, and I think that's the point of not losing Rutherford's letters, for example, not losing Henderson's experiences and read Fair Sunshine. I mean, these people, they walked with God and they experienced His presence.
I think there could be such things as Fair Sunshine, and that could even have a contrast with what the popery brought on them. They couldn't have had the
oh, it wasn't. It wasn't the. It wasn't the idolatry of popery that drove them to worship. It was the idolatry of their own heart.
Just make two comments. One is whenever you read, especially Puritans writing about themselves, you have to read a fair amount to understand what the writing style was. They were all fairly humble individuals and had a self-deprecating technique, if you will, describing their own unworthiness that may not have originated from prior
places. Almost from a warmth and lifestyle.
It was the style which they wrote, so you do have to sort of take it in the grain in which it was written. And secondly, just by way of observation, I don't know, over the last half dozen years, I've taught most of the kids of Christian parents, and their sins are by no way limited to thought sins. I think
they've all been on drugs for
years. They do quite well at hallucinating without them.
Well, I think we've gotten to yet another one of those questions, which we shan't answer in the remaining time. So let's close in prayer. Dave, would you close?